Happy New Year! Happy, happy New Year! Welcome in to All Ball, the All Basketball Podcast. I'm so fortunate to have met people and tell their stories or help them tell their stories along the way. Our guest this week is Matt Thomas. He's a guard or forward or he's a professional shooter, really, right? For the Toronto Raptors. And I got to know him actually through TJ Olsenberger, who just pulled off a massive upset of Utah State coaching at UNLV. TJ's also from Wisconsin. And of course, now the head coach of UNLV, but back then was the assistant coach of Iowa State. And he's like, man, do you know the Matt Thomas story? I was like, no. It's an amazing story. I'll let Matt tell some of it. For those of you who haven't read, I did a piece on it when I was at CBS. Matt was a kid, grew up in kind of hardscrabble Wisconsin. Not really hardscrabble, whatever. Dad had some issues. Parents got divorced when he's 9. Dad had drug and alcohol addiction issues, and his dad killed himself when he's 11 years old. When Matt was 11 years old. And kind of the village of his hometown raised him. And he became a 2-time All-State player. They won state championship. Magnificent high school career. Goes to Iowa State to play for Fred Hoiberg. And really kind of struggled. You know, couldn't get minutes. Didn't seem like he had an advocate. And even though you would think a guy that shoots that well is that smart and that tough, he almost went to play for Tony Bennett at Virginia. Remember, Tony Bennett, of course, grew up in the state of Wisconsin. His dad was head coach at UW Green Bay, so there's some connection there. Anyway, thought about transferring, and boy, he's just an amazing story, an amazing guy, and making it from Iowa State, going through Spain, playing the ACB for 2 years, and now signing a 3-year deal with the Toronto Raptors, he joins us on the All Ball Podcast. Let me give you a couple of NBA thoughts coming off of Christmas break or the Christmas Day game. No real break. You've seen the reports now about Adrian Wojnarowski saying Darren Collison is likely to come out of retirement. I'd heard that as well from a lot of people in LA saying, you know, DC's working out. And he's an interesting guy. He's a tremendous player at UCLA. And he had a really good NBA career and has made himself into a solid starting point guard. And, you know, just he's a Jehovah's Witness. His family and religious issues made him want to retire early, even though he had an offer to play for the Lakers with LeBron James. Well, the Lakers still need a point guard. The Clippers need a point guard. And Darren Collison would like to play in the city of Los Angeles. I think the whole thing's fascinating. Now, maybe even more interesting is what the Lakers would have to do. Would they just cut Boogie Cousins and there they'd have the roster spot? Although that Boogie Cousins roster spot is probably reserved for Andre Iguodala. So then you have one more roster. How do you create the other roster spot? Is it Quinn Cook or is it Rondo? And the fascinating thing with Rondo would be, you know, many in LA have criticized, well, why are you playing Rondo so much? What about Caruso? And obviously, if you go back to the Christmas Day game, Caruso didn't really look like he was ready for that level of NBA. A little too hesitant to even look at the basket. I just think, this is me thinking out loud. I almost think that if the Lakers are going to make that change, they probably make that change and cut Rondo or trade, give away Rondo to somebody else, which is fascinating to go from a guy who's a starting point guard of the Lakers to being cut. But I think part of that is there is the belief that Rondo just at this point in his career, personality-wise, can't take a subservient role. Some guys can go from starter to 5-minute-a-game guy, wave the towel, be the world's greatest teammate. Maybe it's because of ego. Maybe it's just because of how he's wired. I don't know. My feeling in watching is that one of the reasons that Rondo has been in big instances is Frank Vogel. I don't think he's afraid of him. I think he's just trying to figure out, can he win big with Rondo? And I think the answer is no. No matter what he's shooting from three, Rondo can't make big shots. He's never really been a great defender. He's just gotten steals. And he doesn't finish well at the rim at all in the last 5 years. This is my kind of semi-bold prediction. If the Lakers get Darren Collison, I would think they're going to cut Rajon Rondo. All right, let's work our way to the college game before we get you to Matt Thomas. In the college game, look, I do think we're starting to get some clarity on teams. Do I think there's an incredible amount of parity? Of course. That's why there have been so many number one teams in the country. But I think Gonzaga is real, you know? In terms of their depth of talent, their culture of program, their ability to score, I think Gonzaga is real. And they're number one in the country. They do have one loss in the season, obviously. That loss was to Michigan, and they got blown out and didn't play well. And look, I don't know if Michigan's that as good as they played that night. You know, remember in that game, Michigan ends up 12 of 23 from 3-point range. Isaiah Livers just lights them up. So you have a stretch four, and Killian Tilly played in that game. And my fear with Gonzaga is that Ryan Woolridge and Admon Gilder, who are two tremendous players as transfers, and like Gilder's a bucket getter. I don't know how he'll play against St. Mary's and in big games. Same thing with Woolridge. Like Woolridge hasn't played at this level and in super important games in March. How do those guys react? So I do kind of fear that with their guards, and they didn't play well in that game against that level of competitiveness. But I think in terms of being there for the end of the year, they just have so much talent and so much skill. I can't see Gonzaga going away. I think Duke's really good. I just do. And I know they lost at home to Stephen F. Austin, and Trey Jones has been hurt some. But it's a good overall team. You can't compare it to previous Duke teams because they don't have to play previous Duke teams, right? You just had to play this year's teams. And Carolina obviously down, Virginia obviously down. I think Louisville's really good. By the way, speaking of Louisville, you know, I had them as my number one team in the country. And maybe Fresh Kimball's just a bad practice player. Maybe he was a little bit thick. Maybe he just took him. I don't know. But he's fallen back into favor. He got hurt at the end of the Kentucky game, but he's the type of really good college guard leader that this team needs. While, you know, their freshmen kind of come of age. I still think Louisville is an elite team. I think Kentucky's an elite. I mean, Kansas is an elite team. You know, Kansas, Bill has gone to four out, one in, and I do think that he should at least tinker in conference play with a super small lineup, playing Sylvia D'Souza at the five, maybe, and really opening up the floor. But they have a big man that, I don't know, how many big guys are there in college basketball, let alone a guy with that much experience. They have a tremendous point guard, great coaching staff, and awesome culture. Of those four teams, I'd be stunned if two aren't in the Final Four. Hey, one thing I always thought I'd do on this pod is share with you a fun story. Something fun, something funny. And I don't know if I've shared this one before. My man Gary Bell listens to this pod. He's a former teammate at Notre Dame. And so here's my story of the pod. So Gary Bell's from Joliet, Illinois. He was outspoken, loquacious. He was super, super funny. And one of my favorite stories is when I was at Notre Dame during Christmas break, like I think many schools are still on break and you're downloading and listening to this pod. Some are back in session. Instead of having the dining hall and now everybody has training table, we used to get money for breakfast and lunch. And then at dinner, we'd pick a restaurant and they'd pick our meal for us. So there was like no money limit. And I'll never forget this. One night we went to Outback Steakhouse, Grape Road, Mishawaka, Indiana. The way it would work, as I said, was we would have our entire meal pre-ordered. App, salad, maybe some soup, entree, dessert. We had no say in the matter. None. And what ended up happening was we walked into Outback Steakhouse. We sit down. There's no menu. There's no nothing else. And we're all talking. We're all drinking our drinks. And they're starting to bring out all the appetizers we're eating. And G. Bell calls over the waiter and said, "Yo, my man, what we got working for dinner tonight?" He's like, "You know, steaks. You actually can pick which way you want it cooked. What we got for appetizers?" And he tells us, "You know, you got calamari, you got fries, you got baked potatoes, you got this, you got that, you got the blooming onion. What we got working for dessert? Brownies a la mode." So my man G. Bell's from Joliet, Illinois, and he's funny. But I don't think this was intentionally funny. It's one of my favorite stories. He said, "A la what?" It's brownies a la mode. Man, I don't want no Mexican shit. Let's get to Matt Thomas, who, of course, is a guard, a wing, a shooter, a sniper for the Toronto Raptors. An amazing personal story. One that takes us from Wisconsin to Iowa State to jail, all the way back to Iowa State to the NBA.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us in the All Ball podcast. Your story has been talked about some, written about some. I think the whole thing is fascinating. And first, congratulations. What is it like to be an NBA player?
Oh, man, it's good to be here on the pod. But, it's been a fun ride. You know, I had a lot of ups and downs in my life and, you know, in my career. But I wouldn't trade it for anything. I wouldn't trade my past for anything. I'm just extremely fortunate to be in the situation I am in now. I'm just trying to live in the moment and have fun with it.
So, look, you grew up in Dubuque, Iowa. Where's the first place you hooped at?
You know, my mom is from Dubuque. I was born in Decatur, Illinois, actually. I only lived there till I was like 3 or 4, and then the family and I moved to Onalaska, Wisconsin, where I grew up.
All right, so you're in Wisconsin, and okay, so in Onalaska, Wisconsin, first memories of hoop is what?
Probably either outside in my backyard on like the patio with the basketball hoop that we had basically stole/borrowed from our neighbors who played soccer, so they didn't really use it, but it was one of those basketball hoops that you can kind of like roll over. So we got that in our yard, either playing out there or in the house or in the basement. When I was young, we had like one of those Fisher Price hoops. So I used to always play on that.
Who is your neighbors that you stole the hoop from?
They're the Moores. They are the Moores. And like I said, they're a big soccer family, so they always played soccer. For whatever reason, they had a basketball hoop, but they're like, yeah, I mean, once we started playing on it, they're like, yeah, you just keep it. You know, we don't need it. So.
And then I know you grew up shooting and hooping at the YMCA, right?
You know, once I got a little bit older, yeah, the YMCA was a place that I was always at. I was always, you know, the one, like, grabbing the calendar, like, checking the calendar online, figuring out when the gym time was going to be open, or during the holidays, like, making sure the gym was still open, or, like, finding time when I could be there. And then, you know, my mom was always good about making sure I had a ride to the Y, too. And then once I got old enough to drive myself, the YMCA was definitely a place where I developed and played a lot of basketball.
So your dad struggled with addiction growing up. Was it just drinking or was it other stuff?
So, I mean, it was some drugs and alcohol. I was at such a young age when everything was going on with him, struggling with those addictions. And, you know, I didn't exactly know, you know, what was going on. I didn't know anything was going on, you know, so... When he took his life, I was 11 years old. I was 9 when my parents got divorced, and then it was 2 years after that when that happened, when he took his own life. So it was an extremely tough time in my life, but at the same time, it's helped shape me to who I am today, and it definitely brought our family closer together at that, you know, going through that together. And like I kind of said at the beginning, you know, everything that I've gone through has definitely shaped me, and I wouldn't, you know, trade anything.
How have you processed it? Like, you know, you shared the story with me a couple years ago when you were playing at Iowa State. You've shared the story with a lot of other publications. Is it cathartic? Does it feel like a relief to have shared it? Or when you hear it, when people bring it up, and I apologize for bringing it up if it does make you, do you still feel kind of the angst, the agony of what you went through at such a young age?
Sometimes, you know, when it triggers some memories, you know, talking about it and bringing it up. But at the same time, I like sharing it because I feel like I'm in a situation now, and you know, the platform that basketball has given me has, you know, allowed me to, you know, where my story can get out and you know, reach a lot of people. So if, you know, sharing my story can help someone else in need, or, you know, people have reached out to me with, you know, with parents with addictions, or themselves having addictions, just because they saw my story. And, you know, I feel like that's kind of what life's all about, or, you know, my purpose is, you know, to try to help others and inspire and make an impact on others. And, you know, like I was just saying, basketball has given me that platform to do that. So when I share my story, it just allows people to kind of relate to me.
It almost came to an end at Iowa State, right, when you got a DUI. What was take me through that night that you got the DUI. What do you remember about the night you got the DUI?
Most things about it, you know, I was it was between my freshman and sophomore year there at Iowa State. It was in the summer, though, so I think I was 19 or 20 at the time, and you know, I remember the house party that I was at when, you know, when it all went down. And, you know, I was leaving the house party, and like I had done, you know, growing up in Wisconsin, in La Crosse, Wisconsin, it's big, you know, drinking. It's kind of in the culture, and I had done it before, you know, when, you know, just had a few beers or had a few drinks and, you know, got behind the wheel and drove home. Not to say that it's okay by any means, but yeah, you know, the taillight was out and the brake light was out, and I got pulled over, and I was underage, so, but I blew over the legal limit anyways. And that was another, you know, big point in my life, because, not to say I was going down the wrong path, but it definitely got me back on the path that I wanted to be on, and it helped me, like, reprioritize what was important in my life, you know, and that's, you know, my faith, my family, basketball, you know, my friends. And again, I'm glad it happened the way it did, and I was able to learn the way I did without hurting anyone else in the process, and not hurting myself in the process. And, you know, I'll never get behind the wheel after having alcohol again in my life.
What changed in terms of basketball after that moment? Because if you go back, right? If you go back, you had a, you know, your first 2 years, you know, you started half the season your freshman year. You didn't start your second year, and then your junior and senior year. Obviously, Naslong getting hurt helped you in terms of your minutes and number of shots. But what changed for you in terms of basketball?
I changed. You know, I was able to work out more. Like I said, I kind of reprioritized what was important in my life. You know, I wasn't drinking, I wasn't going out. And that happened after my freshman year. So it actually, you know, right away, the results definitely didn't come, because, you know, my entire sophomore year, I was in great shape. My body felt good. I felt like I was good. But because of that DUI, I was suspended the first 3 games. We had a couple of transfers come in who were really talented, who were eligible to play. And I was kind of in that backseat to those guys because of my suspension. Just, it's, you know, in college basketball and in any sport, you know, at the beginning of the season, you know, roles get established really quickly, you know, and me having to sit out those first 3 games for the suspension kind of got me off to a slow start. And my minutes, you know, fluctuated, were up and down that entire year as a sophomore. But like I said, I thought I had a really good year. I developed a lot as a player and a person that year as a sophomore. Going through that, you know, I was going through probation classes and doing a lot of things that I've never thought I would be in a position to do. But then it helped me once my opportunity did come that junior and senior season to fully take advantage of that.
I believe you led the country in free throw shooting your junior year. You shot 90% from the line. What's your routine at the free throw line?
My routine now, at the time, I think it was the same, just one dribble. I just do one rhythm dribble and let it go. I try not to overthink it. You know, I know how good of a shooter I am. I know the work that I put in. I try to just trust my stroke, you know, get that one rhythm dribble and let it fly.
You aim above the front of the rim, front rim, back rim? Like, what is your – everybody says, well, I look for the back of the rim, right? But I don't know what you – when you actually – and maybe now you don't think of, because you've so much muscle memory, is there a spot that you pick out that you aim for?
It's funny because, yeah, as a kid and as I've got older, I've been told to do different things that I don't necessarily do as a shooter. I've been told to like look at the back of the rim, where I always look at the front of the rim. I've also been told never to, you know, watch the ball once it leaves your hand. And I've always, when I shoot the ball, once it's in the air, I watch the arc. I watch how it's flying through the air until it goes in. So those are a couple of things that I've just always done. And like you said, it's all muscle memory at this point. But, yeah, when I'm shooting free throws or, you know, any shot on the court, I've always been a front of the rim guy. That's probably why I normally miss short, but, but no, I've always been front of the rim guy.
Okay. I mean, your story is amazing, but I also think like the technical aspects of your thought process as a shooter, because there is a repetition to it. There is a work ethic to it. Like, is there a number of shots a day that you always get up? Is there, you know, what is the routine that's built you into this unbelievable shooter?
Yeah, I always get asked that same question, is like, how many shots do you get in a day, or how long do you spend at the gym? And I've never been able to answer it, because like for me, it's kind of just I'm in the gym, and it's when I feel like I've put in enough work or I feel good about myself, then I leave. And normally that ends up in me sometimes overworking myself. So I've had to kind of find that balance as I've got older, and try to be smart and not kill myself or kill my body, especially like when it's the day right before the game, because you got to stay fresh. But you know, I've just always been a guy like I want to make sure I get in as much work as I need and to feel good. And that's never been just like, hey, I'm gonna make 10 shots at this spot and then 10 at this, and then when that's done, I'm out. It's always, I always normally end up doing extra stuff.
Matt Thomas is our guest on the All Ball podcast. Let's go back to Iowa State. In addition, you know, to what happened with your father, the OWI, which is the term for the DUI that you got, you're suspended 3 games. Fred Hoiberg also left, right? Like, you got all these other things going on, and Steve Prohm becomes your head coach. T.J. Altsenberger, he comes back, who a Wisconsin guy, is now the head coach at UNLV. How did that work? How did they keep you? What was the relationship like that kept you on track in terms of who was your guy that you talked to and you dealt with during your junior and senior year?
Yeah, I mean, with TJ coming back, because, you know, TJ was the guy who recruited me out of high school, who I became really close with and who I'm still close with today. And him coming back from Washington at the time to Iowa State my junior year was really big for me, because in those first 2 years, I didn't really have anyone in my corner on the staff, you know, and having TJ there, you know, in my corner definitely helped me my junior year, just getting comfortable, because those first 2 years, you know, they were tough both on and off the court. And like I said, I was in a good place with, you know, with my game and my body. I just hadn't been able to, you know, produce or really had the opportunity to produce until that junior and senior year. So he was a great, you know, resource, and he's been a great mentor for me my entire life.
Your last game your senior year was at the Bradley Center in Milwaukee. Considering everything you went through, right? Coaching changes, assistant coaching changes, your own kind of personal growth. When you close your eyes and you think back, kind of the irony to losing and then losing in your home state, losing in Milwaukee, all your family and friends, like, is it positive memory? Like, what are the memories like of playing your last game? Like, look, everybody in college basketball except for one team loses their last game. But sometimes it's the place, sometimes it's the way. What do you remember about how it ended?
It was tough. It was definitely cool, though, for me. If I can remember, yeah, that was the first time, I think, in my entire career that I played back in my home state. You know, we never played Wisconsin or Marquette or Green Bay. I think we played Milwaukee, but it was in Ames. So that was the first time I actually played in my home state. So it was really cool having so many friends and family there. We had a tough matchup, playing against Purdue. You know, I think our that year, like, Deontay Burton was playing the five for us, and he's 6'5" on a good day. And, Purdue had Caleb Swan again, and, Isaac Hodge, just two guys that they just had a little bit too much size for us to handle. So it was a tough matchup for us, but I myself, I remember I played great that game. You know, I really got in a good rhythm from the beginning. I'm pretty sure you'd have to check the stats, but I want to say I was like 9 for 11, 9 for 12 from the field and had 20 points. So it was tough going out that way, especially after having a good game. You know, you want to keep playing. And I can't remember who else was in that bracket, who we would have played in the Sweet 16. But just to have another game in my home state and then potentially advance, and it's always tough, you know. It was tough for, you know that your college career has come to an end, but, you know, I was confident that there was going to be more basketball for my future.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, right, that if you look back, and by the way, you were 9 of 11, 2 of 4 from 3. Yeah, you only started with an offensive rebound. You also had 3 assists, no turnovers, 20 points, 37 minutes, and, you know, you guys made a furious comeback in the second half and came up a little bit short of Purdue. But you look back and you're starting lineup, right? Like Deontay's in the league. Naz in the league, isn't he, right? And then
Yep, he's on the Pacers. Monte Morris is in Denver. So I mean so that roster had 3. Is there, and then I mean I played with George Niang, who's with Utah, Abdul Nader. But those guys, I was a senior that year, but those guys were gone. But I played, yeah. And that's just a tribute to, you know, Iowa State and both Fred Hoiberg and Steve Prohm for, you know, giving us so much freedom offensively and kind of just teaching us how to play the game and how you know the way they teach the game definitely translates to the NBA. And that's just a testament to that is all of us having success right now at the next level.
If you were to advise a high school kid, right, and obviously Iowa State was a place that's near and dear to your heart. How much of, because I've had a lot of discussions with college coaches. I like, look, the way you should separate yourself is make yourself like an NBA program, run NBA style stuff, you know, allow your guys kind of NBA style of freedom. Is that like, I think we sometimes focus too much on, I do think that going somewhere you can play is important, but guys focus on the wrong things. Like to me, go somewhere you can play. I agree with you that you need to have an advocate because, you know, if you have one guy in that coach's office that really fights for you. But I also think go somewhere where the style fits you, right? And then you got to go somewhere, I would say, in which you're going to be comfortable if you're not playing basketball in terms of proximity to home or the style of school, small town versus big city. Like, if you were going to advise a kid on how to pick a college, seeing as you've been through it and now you've made your way to the NBA, what's the process you would go through now in your mid-20s as opposed to when you're in your teens?
That's a loaded question. I think we could have a whole separate podcast just on this topic, but
that's the whole purpose of this topic. You're living the life that every white kid in the Midwest dreams of, right? And so, yeah. Right? So, and sometimes you do overthink it, right? Like when I went to Notre Dame, I thought, well, John McCloud, NBA coach, I get to play right away. Notre Dame's on TV. And what we didn't pay enough attention to was kind of like style of play. Like, yeah, he'd coach Mark Jackson and had, you know, had success, had 2 point guards with the Knicks. But he didn't have necessarily a point guard like me, and he didn't really have – even though he was an NBA coach, it wasn't – it was a weird fit, you know?
For sure. It's interesting because, yeah, but at the same time, so – because I always say for us at Iowa State, like, we had so much freedom that also kind of took away from some of the success I think we could have had as a team in college because it got to the point where sometimes guys abuse the freedom. And that's the thing that some of the great college teams and the teams that usually win, like, national championships, they're very, very disciplined and they take care of the ball. They don't turn it over. I mean, you look at a team like Virginia last year. And you look at Virginia, too, they're able to translate good pros at the same time.
Right.
While also winning in college, where there's other programs that have had success with maybe similar styles that haven't. You know, necessarily churned out pro like good
Wisconsin.
When I say pros, I'm saying NBA players. Where I mean, a lot of teams, like,
Wisconsin.
You can have. I mean, I'll be the first to say you can go to and have a great career and a great life playing in Europe. You know, that's what I was doing my first 2 years. But specifically translating to the NBA, I think you look at a school like Kentucky. I mean, like Calipari, he's open about it. He's obviously he wants to win, but his first priority is getting these guys to the NBA. Where I don't think that's necessarily every college, you know, every coach's goal. You know, they're trying to win a national title, where Calipari is literally just trying to get guys to the NBA, and he's been doing that every single year. So it's an interesting topic, man, and I think, like you said, we could sit and talk about it for a while.
No, I want to sit and talk about it for a while. Like even the Calipari stuff, like he runs floppy, but he's not running some of the pistol stuff. Like he's not, and I'm just, and some of it is, you can't run stuff for shooting bigs when you don't have shooting bigs.
You got to have the personnel. You got to have the personnel for sure.
Yeah, whereas I think Villanova, I think guys are getting drafted out of Villanova not necessarily because they're of the stuff they're running, right? They run just a lot of, they run like five things, like a lot of roll and replace. But I think it's the culture there, right? Those guys get better. Those guys, they're unbelievable with their jump stops and their passing and their level of toughness defensively. Yeah. Like, I think those guys get drafted based upon their culture more than their actual skill.
That plays a factor, too. I mean, you go look at Villanova, yeah, they have guards coming out of there every year now. And like you said, if you teach the fundamentals and everything, and like an NBA GM knows what you're getting when you draft a guy out of Villanova, almost, so to speak. It's interesting. It definitely is interesting because, and then you're talking about Nova too. They might run five things, but you look at the NBA. There, it's no secret. Every team's running the same stuff. You know what teams are going to run. It's just a matter of if you're able to guard it or you're able to, it's a make or miss league. Most guys, you're going to get your what you want. It's just a matter of can you guard it well enough to make them miss.
Okay. So you finish up playing. And what was you get back to Ames? And you're packing up your stuff. Did you meet with Prome? Did you meet with TJ? Like, how did it work in terms of trying to figure out who's going to be my agent and what am I going to do?
Yeah, Prome definitely met with him after the season, just the end of the year type stuff. And he's been good about trying to stay in touch. And we do an alumni event every summer. And actually, last year was the first year that I was able to make it. It was tough, when I was playing in Spain because our summers were so short. But he's been great at like keeping us as alumni connected to the organization. But back when I was a senior, right after that Purdue game, and trying to think about the next step, TJ was a guy that has been a mentor for me my whole life, and that was a guy that connected me with my agent. Alex Tirasis, and I met with him, and I just felt like him and I really connected and shared a pretty similar vision for my career, and that I decided to sign with him, and I think that was a huge decision and a good decision that I made. I'm very fortunate that I'm with him, and right now it's funny because he actually sat in my living room and kind of said to me like, look, right now it's probably not realistic for you to play in the NBA, but I think in 2 to 3 years, there's no reason why you can't, and it's funny that, that's basically came to fruition, 2 years later now, playing with the Raptors.
All right, so you played with the Lakers in the Summer League the first year, and you played pretty well. Did you, what was that like in terms of your thoughts on whether or not you were going to, get an invite or get a contract to stay there?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting the way it all went down because, I was playing summer league with the Lakers. Our first three games, I didn't play much. That was the year they drafted Kyle Kuzma, Lonzo Ball, Josh Hart. There's another Villanova guy, Josh Hart. Brandon Ingram was playing with his summer league team. And just we were loaded, a few of those guys had minor injuries, so they ended up sitting out like after 2-3 games, and all of a sudden I'm starting with one of their current players right now too, Alex Caruso, him, myself, Zubic, who's now with the Clippers. I think Kuzma was still playing, and then Travis Ware, actually, that was like our starting five. And that was like last 5, 6, 7 games of summer league. I was starting and playing big minutes, and just shot it extremely well. I probably shot 60 from three in summer league. So I was hopeful. This was one of the first years I think they had the two-way contract with the NBA and the G League. So I was hopeful and optimistic that the Lakers would offer that to me, given how I played and just how my game translates to the NBA. Being able to shoot it so well. But it didn't come. And, you know, I didn't want to do just a G League, you know, like an Exhibit 10 where you go to training camp and get cut, and then you're kind of – they kind of hold your rights to play solely in the G League. I felt like I would develop more as a player and person, you know, playing in Spain. And that's why I elected to make that decision.
Okay, so do you remember the conversation you had? Because I think Magic and Rob Pelinka were running the team then. Did Rob call you in? Because I played in Summer League with the Lakers. I went to their three of their free agent camps, but never to their vet camp. Like, you get done with Summer League, they call you in and say you should go to the G League. Did they advise you? How did it go down?
No, it all kind of just happens through your agent, you know. So we were in Summer League in Vegas, and, you know, I went home back to Wisconsin, and then, you know, just got it. I didn't have any, like, direct communication with Robert Magic, you know. Obviously, you know, I met them in person, obviously, but no, like, nothing like business or anything like that, or, you know, what my future could entail, you know, with their organization. You know, that was all just through my agent, Alex, and like I had said, you know, they offered, you know, a training camp deal where I could come to camp, and then, you know, they would hold my rights, you know, to play in their G League team. It's called like an Exhibit 10 type contract.
Yeah.
And like I said, I just thought for me to develop as a player and also a person, you know, to that point, it was like a player in person, I'm saying, to go to Spain and develop, because to that point,
never been out of the Midwest.
I hadn't necessarily left my comfort zone. You know, coming out of high school, I was strongly considering going and playing for Tony Bennett, you know, at Virginia. But the distance was actually one of the things that kind of held me back. I wanted to stay close enough to home, where my, you know, my friends and family were able to see me play. You know, that was important to me. But it was an opportunity for me to kind of get out of my comfort zone. You know, like you said, leave the Midwest. I feel like, you know, as I've got older, I feel like you can really only grow as a person when you put yourself in situations to kind of get out of your comfort zone and get out of your you know, the lane, your lane, I guess you could say. And that's why I felt like it was a better opportunity to go to Spain and develop as a person, but just the style of play in the game and the role that I was going to be getting myself into on the team that had offered me a contract in Spain was a perfect situation for me.
All right, so what was the team, and what do you remember about the first trip there?
The team is it's called Obradorio. It's in Santiago de Compostela, Spain. And when I first heard about it, I knew nothing about the team, nothing about the league. It's funny, though, I actually did go to Spain. That's where I went on my foreign tour while I was at Iowa State, and that was also right in between my sophomore and junior year. So we talked about, you know, that summer with TJ coming back, we had that foreign tour. Those were all big reasons, you know, I was able to kind of shift gears and have such success my junior and senior year. Was, you know, this foreign tour right before was a good opportunity for me as well back in college. But I had a little experience, you know, being in Spain, just because I had visited those cities. When we went in college, we were in Madrid, Barcelona, and Valencia. And then Valencia is actually the team I played with my second year. But that first year in Spain, I was in Obradorio. And my first trip, once I got there, it's just kind of a culture shock. You know, I remember, man, my first time I went to the grocery store, I was probably there for like 2 hours just trying to get like 10 things. It's just, I'm on Google Translate trying to ask questions and, you know, definitely out of my comfort zone, like I was saying. But
like when you showed up, like at the airport. At the airport, you fly in where, like Madrid, and then connect.
Okay. I went Chicago, Madrid, yeah, and then connected, Santiago. It's a smaller city, and like it's in the northwest of Spain. I would compare it to like they call it, like it rained quite a bit. You know, no snow. Which was nice, but it rained quite a bit. Gets a little cold, you know, in the winter months.
So you show up at the airport. Do people speak English? Because like, when I was in Russia, nobody spoke English. But it's different in that part of Spain. Yeah. It feels like a lot of people spoke English.
Yeah, it's different. Definitely, definitely the bigger cities, you know, Madrid, but like those cities, there's a lot more English. There was still some English being spoken, and like within the team, and you know, my coach, you know, did his best to speak English, and I got pretty familiar with like European, you know, broken English. You know, I can understand it. I mean, their English is much better than my Spanish, so we usually elected to just try to speak English, you know, and that was nice. But when I was out in public is where it'd be a little bit harder. I eventually over time learned a little bit of Spanish. I was able to like get by in social settings and, you know, at restaurants and when I'm at the supermarket or at the mall. But yeah, right away I remember
okay. So you start playing, like, did you know right away you fit? I mean, like, they're in Liga ACB. What was the level of competition like?
It was extremely competitive. Like I said, when I got there, I knew kind of what role. Because I actually had met with the head coach and the GM of this club while I was in Vegas. They saw me in Vegas, and that's when they started to show interest, and they, you know, offered me the contract. So I was able to sit down with them. And they kind of shared their vision with me and, like the role that they felt like I could have within the team. You know, so all that happened before I got there. That also helped me with my decision to go over there, just being able to meet them face-to-face. And I kind of knew what I was getting myself into a little bit. But the league is great. I mean, the league is extremely competitive, I'll say that. And there's a lot of really good players, and the teams compete. The coaching is great. Like I said, I feel like I really developed, you know, in my time there. I learned a lot, and I got a lot better as a player.
Your second year, you go to Valencia. What's the transition like? Because I don't know if people, I mean, like, look, Hoop guys, they understand that's a huge club. But what was the biggest difference in terms of, you know, going from Rio Natura to going to Valencia?
I mean, I think the biggest difference is just I was playing in, once I got to Valencia, I was playing in two competitions. With Obradorio, we just played in the ACB, just one game a week. And that was an adjustment too, coming from college, where you're accustomed to playing 2-3 games a week, and, you know, the season's maybe 5 months. Now my first year playing as professional, my season is 9 or 10 months, and I'm playing once a week. Like, we only played like 34, like, it's the same amount of games as a college season, essentially, but it's just extremely stretched out. So, like, we're having 2 days practices, like, right during the middle of a week. Like, it kind of feels like preseason. And we went through a stretch where we lost, like, 6-7 games in a row that year, actually. And so we hadn't won a game in almost 2 months. Where then I get to Valencia, we're playing in, we're still in the ACB in the Spanish league, but then we're also playing in Euro Cup. So I'm playing 2 to 3 games a week, and I'm playing in, you know, all over Europe. I'm playing in Turkey. I'm playing in Russia. I'm playing in Germany and Italy, you know, and then I'm obviously in Spain. But that was a really cool experience for me, just traveling throughout Europe, and then it's higher level of competition as well, playing in the Euro Cup.
When you got to Valencia, also there were other Americans, right? Like Mike Toby played in your team. Right. Whereas I think when you were your first club, were you the only American?
We had so in Spain, in the Spanish league, you're only allowed two. So I had another one in my first team too. His name is Ben Simons. He played college at Drake, college basketball at Drake, and I still stay in touch with him. He's playing now in Germany. And then now, and like you said, in Valencia, Mike Toby was the other American. And he's still in Valencia now too. And he would always give me shit about how they beat us. It was my junior year, his senior year. Virginia beat us in the Sweet 16 when we were playing in Chicago. So he would from time to time give me a hard time about that loss.
So when you get to Valencia, what was your day like? You know, is it just you and Mike Toby hanging around? Like what's on a daily basis?
I mean, I spent a lot of time with Mike. It was good because we were both the same age, and we were both single. You know, that's one thing too. Once you turn pro, you know, you have teammates of all ages, and they're at all different points in your life. Whereas in college, you know, everyone's 18 to 22, and everyone's, you know, kind of doing the same stuff. All of a sudden, you turn pro, you know, I had guys that were 35, 36 who had, you know, wives and 2-3 kids already. But I that is one of the things, too, in both teams, my teams in Spain. You know, I had extremely good teammates, you know, that were great to me and helped me with the transition. On both teams, I still stay in touch with guys I played with. In Valencia, I played with, you know, I spent a lot of time with Mike. There's a Canadian that I played with, Aaron Dornekamp, and then one of the Belgian point guards, his name's Sam Van Rossum. Those three guys are all still there, and those three guys I still stay in touch with to this day. And Aaron, the one from, he's actually from Toronto, so he was pretty pumped up for me when, you know, the deal and everything happened for me this summer with the Raptors.
Yeah, so you finished in Valencia. This is going back to, you know, last season. What did your agent tell you in terms of the NBA, in terms of going back to Valencia? Like, what was that like?
I felt like, you know, I was going back to Valencia, you know. You know, Alex had told me, you know, in my first years in Spain, you know, that NBA teams had been showing interest, and, you know, it could happen this summer. It could, you know, but I never wanted to get my hopes up. I had signed a 2-year deal in Valencia, so I knew, you know, I knew I was going back. We had won Euro Cup, so we were, you know, I was going to have the opportunity to play in Euro League, you know, in my second year of the contract, and I was excited for that. I also finished the year. I was injured, so I actually wasn't even healthy to finish the season in Valencia. So I didn't anticipate, to be honest, anything really happening, you know, with an NBA team. For me, you know, this year, I didn't know for sure if it would happen. Like I said, Alex had been telling me things that, you know, that it could. But I never wanted to get my hopes up, and I also just tried my best to live in the moment. And until anything happened, that's what I did. But then once I found out, you know, that the Raptors were interested and wanted to put an offer on the table, you know, definitely an exciting time for me. And everything moved pretty quick you know, getting the physicals and getting up to Toronto, getting the physicals, and then you know, the two sides had to work out the like I said, it was a 2-year contract, so the Raptors had to pay the buyout in my contract for me to eventually then sign with the team.
And so your first year is guaranteed, second year partially guaranteed. What is it? I mean, that's that you signed that paper, you knew you were an NBA player. What was that moment like?
It was a very special moment, man, because, like you said, every white kid in the Midwest, you know, you grow up watching the NBA, and that's your dream, is to become an NBA player. And I've worked extremely hard my entire life, you know, for this moment. And, you know, it's not just myself either. It's, you know, a lot of people go through the journey with you. You know, my immediate family, obviously, you know, I think back to my mom driving me all over the Midwest, you know, to AAU tournaments and, you know, being there every step of the way, and all the games, you know, they came to it at Iowa State. You know, my high school coaches, you know, guys like TJ Altsberger, who have been mentors for me. You know, it just, you know, it brings back a lot of memories, and you know, it definitely makes all the hard work that you put in over the years. It makes it all worth it.
So you didn't play the first 2 games of the year. Third game, you play the Bulls, and you know. You guys are, and by the way, you're coached by a guy who also Midwest roots, coached in Iowa, right? Nick Nurse. He comes down and puts you in. Do you remember checking into your first NBA game against the Bulls?
Oh, yeah, definitely remember. That'll be a moment, you know, I don't forget anytime soon. We were on a back-to-back, you know, we had played in Boston the night before. You know, so I was actually kind of optimistic, you know, like you said, didn't play in the first 2 games, but I was like, you know, with us having back to back, you know, it's early in the year, you don't want to just overload guys' minutes, you know, too early. You know, I thought there'd be an opportunity potentially for me playing in that game. And it was special for me too, because, you know, Chicago's 3-4 hours from my hometown. So I had a lot of family and friends there at that game. And that was actually the first game, I think my mom, all three, my mom, brother, and sister were all in, at the, you know, there together. They had visited me in Spain, but at different times. So like for those three to all be there together, that was the first time since college. So it was only fitting for me to kind of have my NBA debut and get out there and play my first minutes and knock down a couple shots, you know, in Chicago on that day.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, right? To go to play in Chicago.
Yeah.
Did you made two threes? Did you make your first one?
I did. I made my first two right in the first half, and then I missed one in the third quarter, I think, or third or fourth quarter in the second half at some point. But yeah. I ended up playing 20 minutes that night and went 2 for 3. And, you know, I definitely had a lot of energy. So I was out there, you know, trying to be all over the place.
Okay. I got two more for you really quickly. First,
for sure.
How good is Luka?
Man, he's big time. So I actually played him in Spain my first year.
I know.
So that would have been when he was 17. I don't even know. But, like, what he's able to do and just the pace that he plays at, he just plays at his own speed. I think people don't realize how big he is. He's legit, like, 6'8", out there playing point guard. He's special, man. And, you know, I didn't know that he was going to come to the NBA and have this big of an impact this quickly. You know, I didn't think he'd be scoring the way he's scoring. But, I mean, I think he's came out and said it as well that, just in the NBA, the game, the way it's played, there's a lot more space, and it's easier to put the ball in the basket. It's easier to score than it is in the European game. But he's a special man, and you know, fans should just enjoy him.
The best player in Spain that you had never heard of, and then you're like, I had never heard of this guy before, and he's unbelievable.
Oh, that's tough. Actually, probably Corey Higgins. He was playing when I was in Spain. He was playing at Cheska Moscow. He signed in Barcelona, so he's playing there this year. But I didn't know who he was. I looked him up. He played played college at Colorado.
Sure.
But he's really, really good. That's the thing. The average fan too, I think, disrespects Europe and just the level of talent that's there. There's plenty of guys in Europe that could be in the NBA right now. And when I say that, I mean, like, they literally could be in the NBA right now, but they just elect to play in Europe because, for whatever reason, their wife, their kids, their life is there now. They're making better money. They have a better role than they could on the NBA team. But some people everyone here thinks, you know, if you're not in the NBA, then you're not, you know, a good player or whatever. And it's a joke because there's so much talent and really, really good teams playing in Europe.
All right, last thing. Best thing about playing in the NBA is what?
Well, shoot, man. Right now I'm in Miami talking to you outside, actually, right now. It's like 80 degrees out. So that's one of the good things. We stay at five-star hotels and we travel in private jets everywhere. And you get to be in all the best cities in the country. That's one of the perks.
If you were to give advice to somebody else who's going through what you went through when you were 11, when your dad killed himself, and seeing your success now, what would it be?
To someone who's going through...
Yeah, somebody's, you know, going through losing a family member, some sort of strife. I mean, hopefully not.
For sure.
You know? What would the advice...
For sure, yeah, no. Yeah, my advice to someone who's going through a tough time, you know, like that, would just be, you know, keep your faith, keep believing, and just continue to work. You know, that's the one constant thing that I've done my entire life is continue to work through all the highs and the lows. Like the work in the process doesn't change. You know, I was told once that if you fall in love with the process without being emotionally attached to the outcome, you're probably going to eventually love what the outcome brings. And I've tried to continue to have that mindset and just continue to work, and regardless of the outcome, just every single day, just continue to work. And to this point, it's worked out pretty well for me.
Yeah, I would say. Hey, listen, enjoy Miami. I won't take any more of your time on South Beach. Can't wait to see you when you get to LA. In the meantime, congratulations and thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks a lot, Doug. It's good to talk again. Good to catch up, and happy to. Hope to see you in LA.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
So that's it for All Ball. Remember to listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app. Make sure you tell a friend, download, subscribe, and rate our program as well. My thanks to Matt Thomas. I'm Doug Gottlieb. Happy New Year. This is All Ball.